Let's talk about the S&P 500 index, what it is and why it is not the appropriate benchmark for your portfolio. And this is the 89th episode of the Retirement Planning Education Podcast.
Welcome to the Retirement Planning Education Podcast, where you can learn all about IRAs and Roth IRAs, employer retirement plans, taxes, Social Security, Medicare, portfolio withdrawal strategies, annuities, estate planning, and much more. And now here's your host, Andy Panko.
Well, hello, everybody. Today we have a fun one, a little different. It's not going to be about the technical, taxy, financial planning, distribution-y sort of stuff we normally talk about, but I think many of you will find this one interesting. Today, I'm going to talk about the S&P 500 index, which you've all probably heard of. Many of you know what it is. Many of you may not, but again, I've heard of it. So I'm going to break down what it is, why it's important, what to do with the information. And secondly, I will explain why it is not the appropriate benchmark for you and your portfolio in almost all cases. There could be some where it is, but for the vast majority of you listening, knowing the returns of the S&P 500 could be interesting. And it is a good bit of info to be aware of, but it is not the returns against which you should benchmark your portfolio and how they're performing. And I will explain why. But before I do that, I have a question for you. What is it called when you kill chickpeas? Hummus-eyed. Oh, what? So I don't have my little sound machine here with the laugh track and stuff because I'm recording this from my home as opposed to my work office where I have my fancy little mixing board. Because it is currently a snowstorm here in New Jersey, and I didn't feel like going to the office. So here I am in my basement having fun with this microphone. No laugh track, sorry, but I hope that did not take away from the quality of that joke. Cool, moving on. All right, so S&P 500, what is it? It is an index that measures the change in price or change in value of the U.S. stock market. Now, specifically, how does it do that? Well, it looks at all the publicly traded stocks in the U.S. on U.S. stock exchanges and takes the 500 largest of those stocks, wraps them into this index, tracks the aggregate price change or prices and price change of those 500 stocks, and that's the index. So the index value of the S&P 500 is this sort of blended, weighted basket single measure that is meant to be indicative of the price of the 500 stocks that are part of that index. So it's not necessarily just U.S. stocks. It's stocks that trade on U.S. exchanges is what I said, of the 500 largest stocks on U.S. exchanges. So there could be some foreign companies. There's something called ADRs, American Depository Receipts, where foreign companies, foreign stocks could in effect have a U.S. version of their shares created so they can trade in U.S. dollars on U.S. exchanges and get access to the U.S. market. So there's actually many companies like Nestle, for example, is one of them, I believe, a Swiss company, but has shares that trade in the U.S. And I'm just making this up, but I do believe if Nestle is large enough of a stock that its shares would be included in the S&P 500, but I haven't confirmed that. I'm just saying this on the spot. But so that's what it is. Again, it is meant to be or intended widely viewed as indicative of the U.S. stock market as a whole. I have some comments on that. There's a few other indices and a few other pros and cons to each index as to why they are or aren't actually indicative of the whole U.S. market. So, for example, there's also the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which is only 30 companies. And that's meant to be or intended to be indicative of the broader U.S. stock market. In my view, I think that index is kind of goofy and should just go away at this point because 30 stocks, while yes, the 30 in there are major, what's called blue chip bellwether names in their respective industries, it's only 30 companies. Like, I don't know how you can view that as indicative of the stock market as a whole. The S&P is 500 companies. Now, there's some different methodology in how they weight the different names in the Dow Jones versus the S&P, and I'll touch on that in a moment. But my view, Dow Jones, it's the oldest index, so I think that's why it's still around. It has some sort of nostalgic legacy value, and it's the one commonly quoted first in the financial media. But again, it's really, might as well just throw it out. It doesn't really do much, in my opinion, because the S&P is so much more robust and better. A few other notes. notice I said it's publicly traded shares in U.S. markets, U.S. stock exchanges that are included in the S&P 500. It does not include private companies. So there's some really large private companies you all have heard of whose shares, whose company values are not in the S&P 500 because they don't have shares that publicly trade. These companies are held privately. For example, Cargill, Coke Industries, Publix Supermarkets, formerly Twitter, now known as X, Hobby Lobby. These are all, some of them, household names that you've heard of that are not in the S&P 500 because they are not publicly traded. They are privately held. Now, there are about 3,800 publicly traded stocks in the U.S. S&P 500 only captures 500 of them. So you may be saying, how is that possibly indicative of the entirety of the market? It's only what? It's roughly an eighth of the whole market. Well, I feel it is, and I'll explain why. But just so you know, it's not all stocks in the U.S. It's just the top 500, obviously, hence the name S&P or Standard & Poor's is what S&P stands for, Standard & Poor's 500. The way in which the individual stocks are weighted, or you know how much each company, each stock is, how much heft it has in the index, is weighted by what's called market capitalization or market cap. Stick with me here. This is a little technical, but it's important to know. When there's a publicly traded stock, you know the stock price, obviously. You can go to Yahoo Finance. You can look at the newspaper, if the newspapers even still have stock quotes. You can look on CNBC, scrolling ticker. You can go wherever, and you can find a stock's price. So let's assume any given share, just company ABC, I'll call it, has a $100 per share stock price currently. And this goes up and goes down every day. But for now, let's just assume company ABC's stock price is $100 per share. And let's assume there are 5 million shares of company ABC stock out there floating around in circulation, you know, bought and sold daily on US, you know, by investors across US exchanges. So if there's 5 million shares, and each share is currently $100 in price, its market cap is simply multiply those two together. So $500 million is the market capitalization of company ABC in this example. Make sense? And you can do this math. You can do this market cap calculation with any shares out there. Just simply take the number of shares, insert the number of shares outstanding, multiply by the current share price. So market cap will change any given day. The number of shares outstanding is usually fairly static. I mean, it can come and go as companies issue more shares or buy back shares or whatever. But the share price changes, you know, by the second in many cases. So market cap will move around over time for each company. So what the S&P 500 does in order to come up with this aggregate blended single value for the index for these 500 stocks is it weights each of the 500 stocks by their respective market capitalizations or market caps. So all else equal, the larger a company's market cap, the larger the weighting, the larger percentage of the index that share's price will account for, and vice versa. The smallest market cap companies in the index will have the smallest weighting in the index. So that means that the share price change any given day of the largest market cap companies will have much more heft and sway for the S&P 500 index's total aggregate price change than will the smaller market cap companies simply because they're a much smaller portion that they represent much less of the index. With that said, it's important to know that the index, S&P 500, is incredibly concentrated in the largest few companies really account for the lion's share, or at least a really big share, of the total index. So here's some fun info. And I have this episode was inspired by my company's newsletter, the March edition, which if you're not subscribed, you should be because it's awesome. It comes out monthly. There's a link to it in the notes of the show. The March edition of that newsletter, I wrote about, where am I recording this? I wrote about this exact topic, and there's graphs in there and some charts. So it might be easier to read this idea than just listen to it now because there are some numbers involved. But anyway, so that was my motivation for doing this episode. So coming back to as of February 9th, at least, this is when I wrote the newsletter for my company. Here's the largest 20 companies in the S&P 500 and their respective percentage weightings of the entirety of the index. So I'm just going to run through this quickly. Again, there's 500 companies. These are just the top 20 in order. So these, you know, the number one is the largest market capitalization, and then it goes down from there. Number one, Microsoft, About 7.3% of the total S&P index is accounted for by just Microsoft. Number two, Apple, about 6.5%. Number three, NVIDIA, about 4.1%. Number four, Google, about 3.8%. Number five, Amazon, about 3.7%. Number six, Meta, aka Facebook, or formerly Facebook, about 2.5%. Number seven, Berkshire Hathaway, about 1.7%. Number eight, Eli Lilly, about 1.4%. Number nine, Broadcom, about 1.3%. Number 10, Tesla, about 1.2%, 1.3%. And now I won't say the percentages of the 11 through 20, because they tail off pretty quick. Number 11 is JP Morgan at 1.2. Number 20 is Costco at about 0.8. And so the rest are all, you know, in between 1.2-ish and 0.8. So fairly tight band. So number 11, JP Morgan, then United Health, Visa, ExxonMobil, MasterCard, Johnson & Johnson, Procter & Gamble, Home Depot, Merck, and number 20 is Costco, like I said. So those are the largest 20 names in the S&P 500, where large is each company's market capitalization. Those 20 collectively account for 43.1% of the total of the S&P 500. Let me repeat that. The largest 20 companies in the S&P 500 index account for 43.1% of the total index. So for the other 480 companies in the index, it's almost like thanks for showing up. I mean, obviously, collectively, those 480 matter because they account for, 57% of the index. But it's really the top 20 and the price change of those top 20 have tremendously, I'll call it outsized clout in dictating what the S&P 500 index does. The top 10, so top 20 are like a little over 43%, like I said. The top 10, about 34%. The top five, more just over 25%. So Microsoft, Apple, NVIDIA, Google, and Amazon collectively are about 25% of the S&P 500. Five companies drive a quarter of the impact of the S&P 500. That's a lot. Let that soak in. I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm just saying it is what it is. The point is there's a lot of concentration to the top few names, which are all large tech names: Microsoft, Apple, NVIDIA, Google, Amazon, followed by, again, Facebook is number six for what it's worth. So is the S&P 500 really indicative of the broader U.S. stock market, or is it indicative of a handful of behemothly sized tech companies? The answer is both, because for better or worse, those companies are that large, and they do account by market cap, at least, which I think is the most appropriate way to try to view and measure a stock market. They are that large and they do really make up that much of the U.S. stock market. So yes, they are. The S&P 500 is super concentrated in the top few names, but that is also indicative of the U.S. stock market because there is that much concentration. Just for the fun of it, the 500th company, again, this is as of February 9th, 2024. This can all change any given day as market caps change around. But the 500th company in the index, which means the smallest market cap, is News Corp, at about $15 billion of market cap. Or I should have said, so Microsoft, the number one company, has just over $3 trillion of market cap. The 500th company, News Corp, has about $15 billion of market cap. That's about 200 times as large. So the largest company in the S&P is about 200 times the size of the 500th, or the smallest company in the S&P 500. That's pretty interesting, in my mind at least. So, so now you know what the S&P 500 is. You know that it is, at least currently, very concentrated in the top 20, top 10, top five names, where the top few are all large tech names, which isn't good or bad necessarily. It just is. So you may be asking, okay, fine. 500 companies, you're the total stock market that I said is about 3,800 stocks that are publicly traded at least. So how is 500 indicative of 3,800? Well, look at the concentration in the S&P 500 alone. The top handful of names account for darn near half of it, right? And that's only just 500 companies. You add the other 3,300 U.S. companies, which are all even smaller than those that are in the S&P 500, and the weighting of those across the total 3,800-ish U.S. stocks is even that much smaller. So it's like those remaining, remember how I said for the 480 next stocks in the S&P 500, it's like, thanks for showing up. Well, for the remaining 3,300 beyond the S&P 500 that are in the total U.S. stock market, it's the same thing. It's like even more. Yeah, thanks for showing up, but you 3,300 really don't matter all that much. And so what do I mean by that? So there are, if you look at an index called the US total stock market, and there's index funds that track this, that'll say total stock market or something along those lines, that do track these 3,800 companies, look at the returns. Look at the returns of the S&P 500 versus the returns of the US total stock market. And you can do this through whatever tracking software website you want. There's a site called Portfolio Visualizer that I'll share a link to in the notes that I think is really helpful. It's free to use, a lot of good graphics and information. Look at the return of the S&P 500, or at least, you know, pick an index fund that tracks the S&P 500 and compare those returns versus those of the quote unquote total US stock market, which is all 3,800 funds. You'll see the two returns track really close to one another. For example, over the last 10 years, the S&P 500 has annualized about 12.6% return over 10 years. The US total stock market annualized about 11.9% over the same 10 years. And if you look at year by year on this portfolio visualizer tool or whatever other software you want to use, you'll see year by year, the two track really closely. They're not identical, but they're really closely. They track really closely to the point that whether you're looking at just the S&P 500 or you're looking at the total 3,800 publicly traded stocks in the US, it's more or less the same thing, from historically speaking, return-wise. So that's why I'm saying even though the S&P 500 is only 500 stocks, you chart it, you map it versus the true total publicly traded US stock market. And it's like the difference is negligible. Now, yes, again, yeah, I have to note that there is this large weighting and concentration of the top tech names, but that same weighting and concentration persists even in the total stock market fund, because that is also weighted by market cap. So like I said, you know, those other few thousand companies, they really don't have much sway in the price of the total stock market index. So some of you may be saying, fine, if you look at things by market capitalization, sure, of course, the top handful of companies, which are currently large tech companies, dominate the index. What if you look at the index on an equally weighted basis? You look at the 500 stocks in the S&P and don't weight the index by market cap, but simply give every 500 companies an equal 1/500th share of the index's price. How does that then look? And that's called, hold that thought. So I have that information. And again, this is something to be better to see visually. If you pull this up yourself using Portfolio Visualizer or something, use a fund, any fund that tracks the S&P 500. And then there's also a fund, there may be multiple, but there's one fairly common one I'm aware of that's called the S&P 500 Equal Weight Index. You pull that up, look at its returns. That still tracks fairly closely. Now, there's some years where it does kind of diverge. For example, in 2022, the S&P 500 lost 18%. The S&P 500 equal weighted index lost only about 12%. And then in 2023, flip the script. The S&P 500, you know, the market cap weighted one, gained about 26%. The S&P 500 equal weighted index gained only about 14%. That's a pretty big split. So what does that mean? So in 2022, the big tech companies, in effect, lost more than the rest of the rest of the companies in the S&P as a whole. Hence, the S&P, you know, its returns were worse than the returns of the equal weighted S&P 500. And in 2023, it was the opposite. The big tech companies came roaring back, and their gains kind of outpaced, on average, the rest of the gains of the other companies in the S&P 500. So the market cap weighted S&P 500 did much better than the equal weighted. In 2024, year to date, for what it's worth, the normal S&P 500, you know, market cap weighted is up about 5%. The equal weighted is up about 1%. So again, the heft, the concentration, the top few names is really driving the performance, and has been driving the disparity of performance between the normal market cap weighted S&P 500 and the equal weighted for the last few years. That's called lack of breadth. How do you breadth, whatever. It's saying that the S&P 500 returns are really dominated by a top few companies, even though they may be doing really well. If you look at the returns of the other 480, like, they may not be doing so hot. But just on the surface, it looks like, yeah, the US stock market's doing great because the S&P 500 is up a lot. But you dig into the details and be like, yeah, the majority of the companies in the S&P could be down or flat or doing, you know, not very impressive. But the top few behemoth tech names are really running away with the show. So you may say, well, it's not fair. It's goofy that the S&P 500 is market cap weighted and not indicative of the whole U.S. stock market, because you should be looking at stuff on an equal weighted basis, to which I say, fair point. I don't agree. I think it's a good comparison to do and be aware of, that there could be lack of breadth where a few stocks are really running the show and the rest are like, eh. But it is what it is. The stock market is that concentrated, that there are these large names that are that large that really dominate the show. And so therefore it is indicative. All right. That's my thoughts on that in terms of what the S&P 500 is, and the market cap thing and the equal weighted thing. Now let's talk about why this is not the right index for you. All right. Now this was kind of a clickbait name or title, and I apologize in advance, but I wanted to sort of get the message out there. So when people talk about the stock market or talk about investments as a whole, when you just say the word the market, right? What does the market mean? There's lots of markets out there. I used to have this joke with someone I worked with in my institutional corporate days. Someone would say, what'd the market do today? I'm like, what market? The bond market, the interest rate market, the, whatever, Bolivian orange futures market, like any product that trades somewhere is a market. Yet I know what he meant. It was just sort of a tongue in cheek joke. So anyway, when most people say the market, they're referring to the U.S. stock market, and they're probably inherently referring to the S&P 500, whether consciously or not, that's what they usually mean. So in that sense, that's why I said it's good to know what the S&P 500 is doing, how much it gained, how much it lost, whatever, because that is, quote unquote, the market, right? For lack of a more specificity around what you mean when you say the market. But is the market, is the S&P 500 indicative or a fair benchmark for you and your portfolio and how it returns, how its returns are? I would say no, it's not. And so why do I say that? So think about the typical retiree or pre-retiree, which is the majority of you listening to this. Chances are you do not have the entirety of your investable assets in U.S. stocks. Maybe you do. I'm not saying you should or shouldn't, but generally speaking, even if you do have all of your investments in stocks, it's usually prudent to not pile them all into one sector, all into one country, et cetera, all into one small versus large versus midsize. Some people do. I'm not saying they don't, but my view is it's usually more prudent to diversify. If nothing else, diversify across the globe. Don't put all your eggs in the U.S. basket. So if you do have an all-stock portfolio, chances are you have, or probably should have, arguably. This is not investment advice. This is just some thoughts and ruminations. So some international exposure. Whatever country or countries you choose to use, that's up to you. I'm just saying chances are you probably have or want or need or whatever some international stock exposure in your portfolio. So that right there, now your actual portfolio is diverting from being completely U.S. stock. Hence, the returns of the S&P 500 is not indicative of the returns you should expect in your portfolio, because you have things other than the S&P 500, like in this case, international stocks. Now, for what it's worth, through most of history, recent history, you know, last few decades, U.S. stock market, as measured by the S&P 500, has done better than the international stock market, where international means everything other than the U.S. Quick fun fact terminology. When you say global or global stocks, that's the whole world. That's international and U.S. When you say international, that's just non-U.S. It's other countries besides the U.S. So point is, the rest of the world, the stock market of the rest of the world hasn't done as well as the S&P 500, especially since the global financial crisis of 08-09. U.S. has really sort of dominated the show, again, driven by, primarily by these large tech companies, Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, Google, Facebook, et cetera. Netflix used to be up there as well. Not anymore. But that's not always the case. It hasn't always been the case, and it won't always be the case. For example, for the first decade of the 2000s, international stocks actually did better than U.S. stocks, because U.S. had the double doozy of the popping of the tech bubble. So 2000, 2001, 2002 were three consecutive down years for the U.S. stock market. International didn't fare nearly as poorly. Even though the bursting the tech bubble was a global event, it was really U.S. focused, and U.S. took the brunt of it. So we had that, where international performed better than U.S. And then a few years later, we had the global financial crisis, sparked mainly by the mortgage housing crisis, mortgage backed securitizations. There's a whole host of factors that led to it. But the point is that the U.S. stock market performed worse during the crashing of the global financial system. perform worse than international did. So in that sense, you know, that decade, international did better than US and provided a good sort of diversity hedge, you know, a little bit of not having all your eggs in the one US basket thing. But then, like I said, post global financial crisis, US did better. So what's it going to be going forward? That's a $1 million question. If you have a crystal ball that isn't broken, let me know. There's a really strong case to be made that people should have some international exposure because the US stock market is, by many metrics, fairly high, fairly expensive right now. Comparatively speaking, international stocks, international stock market look to be potentially a better value going forward. There's no guarantees. This is all just sort of speculation and people trying to use logic and history and statistics to say we think this is going to be better, but there's no guarantees. So anyway, point is, even though the last decade or so, U.S. stock market's really sort of trounced international. And anytime you say to someone you should have international stock exposure, they'll say, why? Look at the last decade, S&P 500 crushed international, which I'd say, yeah, true. I can't dispute that. But going forward, what if it doesn't, right? There's a good case to be made again that international is going to come back in fashion, maybe, you know, only temporarily, but still. Prudent portfolio diversity would say you should not keep all your eggs in any one basket, including just the US basket. So anyway, so that's one example. Even if you're all stock portfolio, you're not all US stocks, or most likely not. So don't feel bad if your portfolio does worse than the S&P 500 because your international positions dragged you down a bit. Here's an interesting thought or interesting comment. Don't mistake a bad outcome for a bad decision. Here's what I mean. A good decision is, yes, a well-diversified, prudently managed portfolio should have some international stock exposure, not just US stock exposure. That's a good decision. But fast forward 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, there's a decent chance that the S&P, the US stock portion of your portfolio, will perform better than the international portion. That would be a bad outcome. I mean, it's not bad, but it's an outcome that is what it is. You would have fast forward at that point, you may be like, wow, why did I invest in international stocks when US did better? This was a bad or suboptimal outcome. I'd say true. It wasn't the best outcome, but that doesn't mean the decision to invest in international stock in the first place was a bad decision. It was still a good decision. I will stand by that and you know, fight that to anyone who wants to try to argue it. And a lot of this is subjective, so there isn't necessarily a right view or a winner in trying to argue that. I'm just saying I firmly believe in diversity, and that includes some international diversity. So anyway, don't mistake a bad outcome or suboptimal outcome for a bad decision or suboptimal decision. So even if you're not all stock, this is where S&P is even less of a relevant benchmark. You know, typical retiree, pre-retiree, you're probably going to have like a typical, let's just say 60-40 portfolio, where 60% is in stocks and 40% is in bonds, cash, or other sort of more safe, stable assets, relatively safe, stable assets. In that case, then you really can't compare the S&P 500. You know, 40% of your portfolio is in cash or CDs at banks or treasury bills or bond funds or, you know, individual bonds. They definitely will not perform like a broad stock market like the S&P 500. It's not reasonable to expect they will. So if you're looking at the S&P 500 and it did blazingly well over the last 10 years, and you're comparing that versus your portfolio, let's say it's a 60-40 stocks versus bonds, you're going to be, wow, my portfolio is rubbish. It's like, no, it's not. Compared to the S&P, yes, it did not do as well. No one could say otherwise. But you were invested according, let's assume it was appropriate. You know, you made a conscious decision 10 years ago or whenever that 60-40 was the right allocation for you. You didn't want to take too much risk. You need some diversity, et cetera, et cetera. So you picked that and you ran with it. Being diverse means always having to say you're sorry, because there's always going to be something that's going to underperform something else. You're gonna be like, why did I have this when I could have had more of that, which did better? Now, hindsight's always 20/20. It's easy to look back and say, oh man, if I was in all stocks over the last 10 years, I would have killed it. I'd have so much more money now than I do. That could be true. But what if the same, you know, what if the opposite was true? What if it was the first decade of the millennia, you know, 2000 to 2010-ish, and you were all stock? You would not have been happy. Right, you'd be worse off if you were all stock as opposed to if you were in a more blended, diversified 60-40 type portfolio. Anyway, so I guess I can probably wrap at this point. But knowing what the S&P 500 is, looking at it just sort of as a gauge of what the US stock market's doing, those things are fine. If you want to look at it for information's sake, cool. But you should not use that as the benchmark against which you review and sort of decide on whether your portfolio and how its returns were are good or bad. S&P 500 could be one input into that. But if you have, again, the typical sort of 60-40, S&P 500 is in no way appropriate or accurate benchmark for the 40% portion of your portfolio that's in whatever it's in, bonds, cash, you know, cash value life insurance, other sort of non-correlated lower risk assets. You need to then find some sort of index relevant to that. Now, I don't want to get into what index is right. Everyone's invested a little differently. So, there's infinite ways you can come up with some composite or index or benchmark that's appropriate for your portfolio. Just for example, if you are the traditional 60-40 portfolio, you can use, this is probably the easiest way to do it, like Vanguard has what's called Vanguard's Balanced Index Fund. Again, this is not investment advice. I'm not saying you should or shouldn't buy this, sell this, use it as an index, whatever. But the reason why I bring it up is that fund happens to be managed such that it's always approximately a 60-40 allocation between stocks and bonds. So you can use that as just sort of one gauge of what a typical sort of 60-40 portfolio has returned or, you know, should be expected to return going forward. Even that, if you have a 60-40 portfolio and you're comparing it versus that Vanguard fund and its returns, don't be let down if your returns are different, be they better or worse, because your specific mix of what's in your 60-40 is almost certainly going to be a little different than the specific mix of what's in that Vanguard fund 60-40. Maybe it's better, maybe it's worse. Who knows? Again, hindsight's 20/20, but it should at least trend in the same general direction. There'll be some years where your portfolio does better, some years where yours does worse, but it should kind of, you know, if you plot the two lines on top of one another, your 60-40 should generally trend along the same path as the a fund like Vanguard's Balanced Index Fund, which is 60-40. All right. Was there anything else I wanted to say about this? I don't know that there was. I thought I had one more thought about benchmarks. As you can probably tell, this whole index, I mean, there's some data I'm referencing here that I've written down, but otherwise it's really just sort of me waxing my thoughts about all this. So, all right. No, I guess that's it. So I think this one's relatively short. Hopefully you found this interesting and informative. I know lots of people like to talk about and think about stocks and stock funds. So hopefully the first part of this podcast was interesting to you about what the S&P 500 actually is and how concentrated it is in the top few names. As far as the benchmark thing, here's what I want to say about benchmarking. So if whether you invest your own money or you have an advisor who does it for you, if you or he or she invests in index funds, which is increasingly more common, where your stock portion of your portfolio is going to be one, maybe two, three, four different index funds, you know, different stock indexes, and the bond portion or, you know, safer portion of your portfolio is in the same thing, one, two, maybe three bond funds or even in cash, actual cash or individual bill bonds such as US Treasury bills or something. I even go so far as to say it's really not a lot of point in trying to benchmark your portfolio's returns versus some other index or benchmark, be it the Vanguard, you know, Balanced Index 60-40 fund, or be it Morningstar produces some various benchmarks that people can use to reference 60-40 allocation or whatever. Your returns are going to be what they're going to be. And this is sort of hard for some people to accept. If you're investing in index funds, your return in any one of those given funds will be the returns of the index. Now, it'll be slightly smaller because there's fees involved. When you have an index fund, there's some fees to have that fund versus the index isn't an actual investment. Like the S&P 500, you can't invest directly in. It's just this hypothetical reference of stocks. You can't buy it directly. The only way to buy exposure to the S&P 500 is to buy an index fund that seeks to replicate the exposure and the returns of the fund. And because you're buying a fund, there has to be costs associated with creating and running and administering that fund. So anyway, so, you know, your returns of S&P 500 index fund will be slightly lower, generally speaking, than the returns of the actual index because of the costs associated with having that fund. But my point is, if you're investing in index funds, you're not investing in actively managed funds where some portfolio manager is trying to be slick and you know, pick stocks that he or she thinks will do better in the market. Your returns are going to be what they're going to be. Right, each return, each fund you have is just an index fund. So your returns in that fund are just returns of the index. Whether it's good or it's bad, you get what you get. What's going to drive your returns is your allocation and how much money you have in stock funds versus bond funds versus cash. You know, all else equal, the more money you have in the conservative stuff, the lower over the long term your portfolio returns are going to be. Doesn't mean it's bad. I mean, that you know, they probably will be a lot lower than the returns of the S&P 500. But again, that doesn't mean your portfolio is not doing what it's supposed to do, or your returns aren't what they're supposed to be for you and your financial circumstances, your risk profile, and the allocation you chose. So what I'm saying is, in my firm, in my practice, I don't provide benchmarking to clients. I don't say, here's your portfolio, here's how it returned, you know, here's what its performance was, here's the return of this index or that index or a 60-40 portfolio, because I'm not trying to actively beat an index. I know that's a fool's game. It's futile. There'll be years you do, years you don't. You can't control that. My focus is control what you can control. Fees of what you invest in, the overall allocation you pick, how diverse your portfolio is. Are you in one fund or two fund? Are you in, you know, 1,000 underlying securities or 10,000 underlying securities? To some extent, you can control the taxation of how your funds and investments are taxed, or, you know, the tax implications. You can't control what's going to outperform what. So I don't mess around with trying to say, I'm going to put some more money into this sector because I think it's going to do better. I'm going to put more money into US versus international because I think US is going to do better going forward. No, that's just sort of speculation and I won't call it gambling. You can't control that. So anyway, so I don't try to say, here's the returns of your portfolio, here's the returns of index. Oh, man, your portfolio did worse, it's my fault. Or on the flip side, when your portfolio does better, I don't take credit for it. Like, I didn't do that. It wasn't active management. Your returns are what they are for the index products you're invested in and the combination and allocation of how they are. The returns are, you know, you get what you get. We're not trying to beat an index. That's a fool's game, in my opinion. So anyway, I'll close with that. You know, as you can tell, I feel that indexing and benchmarking doesn't really matter when you're investing in index products, because the returns are what they are. I'm not trying to say I can do better or worse than anything. Just these are your returns. So all right, that's that. I will wrap on that. This episode was a little different than usual again, but hopefully you liked it and got something out of it. As always, if you like this podcast, I would greatly appreciate it if you take two shakes of a lamb tail to leave a review, a thumbs up, a like, a what have you on whatever podcast listening platform you use to listen to this glorious show. And if you haven't already, check out the other content sources, the Retirement Planning Education Facebook group, YouTube channel, Retirement Planning Education website, and my company's newsletter, Retirement Planning Insights. You can find links to all those things in the notes of this episode. That's it. Thank you very much. I'm going to go eat lunch now. Take care. See you next time.
The information discussed in this podcast is only general explanations and education. It is not specific tax, legal, or investment advice. Before considering acting on anything you heard here, first consult with your tax, legal, or investment advisor. Thank you.